foremost to the Lieutenant Governor. You know, I came to Iowa for the first time in the fall of 2010, September of 2010, to be exact, and was there to help Governor Branstad and Lieutenant Governor B. Reynolds in their campaign in 2010. I've often told this story, you know, I had only been governor for 9 months, and my secretary came into my office and said, Governor Terry Branstad's on the phone for you. Now, this was ridiculous to me. Like, I didn't think Terry Branstad even knew who I was. And I said, from Iowa? I said, yeah, Governor Branstad from Iowa. So I got on the phone, and he said, you know, he was in a competitive race here running against an incumbent Democrat, just like I had done the year before. And he thought it'd be a good idea, and I might be able to help if I came out and spoke at a fundraiser for he and for Kim. And I said to him, I can't possibly believe that I could be any help at all. And he said, no, I think you could be. And so I came out back in that September, nearly almost 5 years ago now. And it was an amazing event. We had, over 800 people there. It was, and Governor Branstad continued to remind me, it's the most money he's ever raised in one night. And I'm taking full credit for it. I want to thank the Lieutenant Governor for her friendship and her leadership and the great advice that she's given me over time and the great service that she provides to all of you. And I've met lots of Lieutenant Governors around the country, and I can tell you that when Governor Branstad says that he's got the best Lieutenant Governor in the country, he's almost right. I have Kim too. Kim Guadagno is my Lieutenant Governor. She knows Lieutenant Governor Reynolds well. They're both extraordinary public servants, and they're both people who have great, extraordinary futures in leadership in the states where they serve. So, Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for your introduction. I appreciate it. I want to thank all the folks here in Polk County, our co-chairs, and all the different officers and the Central Committee, and all of you who are here tonight. Thank you so much for the invitation. I appreciate it. I tell you, members of the media here tonight, they always ask me, every time I come to Iowa, they ask the same thing. You know, do you really do well in Iowa? I said, well, I don't know, man. People keep inviting me back. If they really thought I was no good, I don't think they'd be inviting me. But, you know, that kind of answer is the typical kind of answer that I give. I've developed over time, I think, a well-earned reputation for being rather direct and blunt and straight. Sometimes people say too much. So I want to start tonight with beginning to at least explain to you where that comes from. Right? Because you need to know those things. And I, like most of you, are a product of my parents. Right? For good and for bad, we are a product of our parents. And I have an Irish father and a Sicilian mother. Now, listen, everybody, what this means is at a very early age, I became an expert at dispute resolution. I don't want to say that my mom was argumentative, but I would say that there was just never an argument she found that was not worth having. And she was also, one of these people who said to us as kids, you are not permitted to suffer in silence. If you've got a problem, you need to speak out, you need to say it, you need to tell us. And she followed that very same rule, much to our chagrin often, when she would be telling us what her grievances of the day were against me and my brother and my sister. And there would come a time as we got older, we'd say to her, Mom, I mean, we know this. Do we really need to hear this now? And she'd say, yes. You need to hear it. I need to get this off my chest. You'll hear it now. There'll be no deathbed confessions in this family, Christopher. You're going to hear it right now. And so that's the way she taught us to be. She used to say to me all the time, her best advice that she ever gave me, and she gave me lots, as you can tell. The best advice she ever gave me was, Christopher, be yourself. Because then tomorrow you don't have to worry about trying to remember who you pretended to be yesterday. And this, my mom told me and my brother and my sister, and she not only told it, but she lived her life that way. And so, you know, being straight and direct and blunt and not pulling any punches is the way mom taught me to be. And, you know, dad loves these parts of the speeches where I talk about my mom all the time. But I told him when he complained one time, he came to one of my town hall meetings in New Jersey, and he came backstage afterwards and he said to me, "You know, you could talk about me a little bit." And I said, "Well, but dad, you know, certain stories I'd like to tell, and you know, most of them are about mom." And he said, "No, I'd really like to talk to me about me a little bit." I said, "Well, come to the next town hall meeting." So he came to the next town hall meeting. I did all that talk about my mom, and I said, "And my dad's here today. And the best way to describe the way I grew up was, in the automobile of life, my dad was the passenger. Mom was the driver. That was my story about him. He didn't like that either." It seems to me, though, that in our country right now, maybe we need a little more of that. Maybe we need a little bit more directness, a little more bluntness, a little more refusal to pull punches, a little more of a sense that our leaders understand that the stakes are really important and that we should make really clear what we believe in and what we don't, what we're willing to fight for and what we're not. And then to give people the confidence that that resolve will result in us doing what we say we're going to do. And I think there have been literally hundreds of failings of the Obama administration that I could detail for you tonight. But the single biggest failing and the single biggest disservice that he's provided to this country during his time in the White House is that no one believes any longer that the American president believes what he says and will follow through on what he says. And that causes problems not only here at home, but around the world. Here at home, it's caused enormous problems. This is a president who has not been able to get along with any Congress. And he has had a Congress of every variety. In the beginning, he had all Democratic Congress. Couldn't get a lot of things done with them. Then he had a split Congress for a number of years. The House was a Republican and the Senate was Democrat. Now he's got all Republican Congress. When you can't get along with any of those three, it is time to go home. There are no other options for you. It's caused us to have the weakest economic recovery from a recession in the post-World War II period. The president goes around and brags about 2% GDP growth. 2% GDP growth is nothing we ever used to brag about. People used to get kicked out of office for 2% GDP growth. The president talks about creating jobs, yet this economy, since prior to the recession, there are 4 million more people today in America working part-time jobs, and there's 3.2 million fewer people working full-time jobs. American people understand that the president's created jobs. The reason they understand it is because they're working two or three of them in many cases in order to make ends meet with what they used to do with one. And this lack of leadership by the president on these issues have also led to problems around the world. I mean, think about the condition of our country around the world right now. I saw the president the other day say on CNN that America is more respected around the world today because of his presidency. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, it is now confirmed. He really is living in his own world. Because just look around the world. This is a president who said to the dictator in Syria, "If you use chemical weapons on your people, we will take you out." And then he used chemical weapons on his people and slaughtered his own people. And the President of the United States said, "Never mind." And when that vacuum was created, where American leadership was promised and then withdrawn, who entered the vacuum to fill it? Vladimir Putin. See, I know that some Americans are weary of it being perceived that America should be the world's policeman. And I don't think we need to be the world's policeman. But we do need to be the world's leader. We do need to be the world's leader. You look across the Middle East. Libya is on fire. Syria is on fire. Iraq is on fire. Iran is moving towards obtaining a nuclear weapon. Syria, Libya, now Egypt under martial law. And the only leader that this president seems willing to stand up to and fight publicly is Bibi Netanyahu, the leader of our ally in the Middle East. He is willing to humiliate in public. Yet our adversaries stand unchallenged. This is a president who is in the midst of negotiations that will lead the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world to join the nuclear club. And this is an agreement that they're already violating. It was reported last week that they have 4 tons more of enriched uranium than they agreed to produce when the negotiations started. If that shouldn't end the negotiations, I don't know what should. This is an agreement where he has nothing in there to say anything about a restriction on the Iranians producing intercontinental ballistic missiles. Those are not missiles that will be intended for their neighbors in the Middle East. Those are intercontinental ballistic missiles, which will be intended for faraway targets. And if you need to wonder what those targets will be, remember that since 1979, when this regime took our embassy and took our hostages, they have been burning American flags and screaming death to America, and they have not stopped. I saw an editorial cartoon in the New York Post a number of weeks back, had the president sitting across from the Ayatollah at a negotiating table, and the Ayatollah was screaming death to America. The president said something like, if that's a deal breaker for you, let's talk. You know, it would be funny if it wasn't true. We now have a Middle East where there is no stability. And that is a bad thing for the American people. Because ISIS now operates out of Iraq and out of Syria. You know, the terrorist group that the president called the JV. He's not calling them that anymore. And for the first time in 70 years, we have Russian troops marching into Eastern Europe. Think about the blood and the treasure that this country has spent to have a free and united Europe. And because Hillary Clinton decided to hit a reset button with Russia, he's now taken Crimea, he's marched into Ukraine. If you're a member, if you're one of the Baltic states, you're a member of NATO, you think that membership's a full membership or a junior membership about now? You think this president is going to assemble NATO troops to stand up for those countries if Putin decides to move elsewhere? And don't forget about China, everybody. Because in the South China Sea, they are building artificial islands in international waters and claiming it as their own. And this president said the policy of this country right now is that he won't sail ships within 12 miles of those islands or fly our planes overhead because he doesn't want to violate the Chinese's claim to those islands where they're building landing strips. Let me tell you, everybody, watch where those islands are. Go on Google Maps. Those landing strips aren't for a luxury hotel. They're not for people to go on vacation. Those are military landing strips where they want to use those areas to control passage in the South China Sea. This is a president who's allowed our national defenses to get to the weakest point they've been since the 1970s. Want our way to 260-ship Navy, 100,000 fewer active duty soldiers in the Army, and a 50% reduction in our equipment in the Air Force. Now, believe me, if I know these numbers, Vladimir Putin knows them, and some of the mullahs in Iran. Aggression happens in this world in response to weakness. And peace happens in this world in response to strength. And this president has forgotten that lesson. And if I did decide to run for president, and if I were ever elected, a lot of things people might say about that bluntness and directness and straightforwardness. But I would tell you this, Vladimir Putin would never have to wonder what I thought was acceptable and what was unacceptable. the Ayatollah in Iran would understand that there would be no negotiations with the United States of America until they publicly said and recognized the right of America to exist and the right of Israel to exist. Until that happens, there can't be any negotiations. And we look back at home, and we see an educational system where of the 34 OECD states around the world, America ranks 27th in math and 20th in science. Listen, everybody, if we keep those numbers where they are, we will not be able to remain the number one economic power and military power in the world. We simply won't have the brain power to do it. Yet we have an educational system in this country where we care more about the comfort of adults than we care about the God-given potential of children. We are being overrun by the educational establishment in this country, run by the teachers' unions who dominate education across this nation in order to promote the worst of their profession, not the best. See, the best teachers don't need protection. We carry the best teachers on our shoulders. They know they are loved and valued in our communities, in our states, and in our country. That's not what the unions are there to protect, everybody. I believe that teachers need a union as good as they are, and they don't have one right now. And what happens then is that every solution to every problem to education, when you listen to the unions, is spend more money. Well, let me give you a message, rather, from a place that spent more money. Almost no state in America spends more money on K-12 education than the state of New Jersey. And let me tell you, the results are not heartening. In the city of Newark, our largest city, we spend $26,000 per pupil per year. Yet, only one of four children in Newark who enter the ninth grade are expected to graduate in 4 years. In the city of Camden, we spend $27,000 per pupil per year. And we get similar results to Newark. And in the city of Asbury Park, New Jersey, made famous by my buddy Bruce Springsteen, right? We spend $30,000 per pupil per year. And 3 years ago, only 50% of the graduating class at Asbury Park High School read at grade level. This fiction that money will fix this problem has been created by the folks who getting more money fulfills their self-interest. Now, we're unwilling in many corners of this country to say it because we don't want to offend anyone. Because we think if we say something against the union, that somehow the teacher that we love in the fourth or fifth grade, or our own child, seventh or eighth grade teacher, may think we don't respect them and like them. Here's all we want. We want a system that rewards excellence. We want accountability in the classroom. If you're a great teacher, I want to pay you more, not less. If you're a great teacher, I want you to stay forever, not just for a few years. But if you are an ineffective teacher, I do not have time to waste my child's time with you in the front of the classroom. And we need to be saying that out loud in America, in every corner of our country. Because the results are in, everybody. I say this to my kids all the time. I ask them how school's going. So I'm working hard, Dad. I'm like, that's great. Glad to hear that. And I'll find out whether that's true when the report card comes. Okay? Because everybody, you are judged by your report card. You are judged by your report card. And the report card's in on us. 27th in science out of 34 industrialized countries. 20th in math. Unacceptable. Unacceptable. With that report card, it's unacceptable for America's future, and we need to change it. We need to put parents in charge of their children's education. Let them choose where to send. For all the money we are spending, parents should be able to decide to send their child anywhere, a public school, a private school, or a parochial school. They should go where their child can get the best education. And injecting competition into our school system would not be a bad thing. Competition in every part of our society forces, creates excellence. Yet, we think somehow in education, forcing competition is somehow unseemly. I understand why. Same thing about higher education. I've been to town hall meetings, as the lieutenant governor was saying, 9 of them just in the last month and a half or so, both here in Iowa and New Hampshire, and I've done 138 town hall meetings as governor of New Jersey in 5.5 years. And in every town hall meeting I've been in since January, whether it was at home in New Jersey or out on the road, I get asked about higher education tuition and student debt. Students and their families are being overburdened with debt. And I said today, isn't it time for some transparency from our colleges and universities? Isn't the college bill the most opaque bill you've ever received in your life? Right? I mean, think about this. I have 2 children in college now. I have a son, Andrew, at Princeton. He'll be a senior in the fall. And a daughter, Sarah, at Notre Dame. She'll be a sophomore in the fall. That bill comes in. It's got 3 lines, right? Tuition, room and board, other fees. Now imagine if tonight, let's say that you didn't eat enough tonight here at the Polk County GOP dinner, you decided to go out for dinner at a local restaurant. And let's say this entire table right here decided to go out. They said, we're having such a great time together. We're all going out together. So they go out to the restaurant together. Everybody orders things. They order stuff to drink. They order stuff to eat. Then the bill comes, and they hand it to the lieutenant governor, of course. And when they hand it to the lieutenant governor, it just says on it, food. $120. Well, I know what the lieutenant governor would do. She would call the waiter or the waitress over very politely and say, hey, listen, I'm happy to pay this bill, but I need to know what this stuff costs. I mean, it's a $120 bill for us, and we have a right to know what it costs. Yet, I get this bill from Princeton or from the University of Notre Dame, and it's got 3 lines on it, and it's not $120. Right? And I just write the check. That's it. I mean, I got a letter from Notre Dame 7 weeks ago from Father Jenkins, the president of Notre Dame. God love him. Wonderful guy. The first paragraph reads something to the effect of, we want to tell you how blessed we feel that you've entrusted the souls of your children to our care and for their education. Now, you can hear the music from Rudy playing in the background, right? You can see in your mind's eye the golden dome. Touchdown, Jesus. It's all there for you, right? Your heart's beating underneath your shirt. Worship, this guy's a priest, right? They know how to get you. Believe me, I'm a Catholic. I know. Second paragraph is the money paragraph, of course. After you hear Rudy and you see Touchdown Jesus, then he comes in for the kill. He says, we're pleased to let you know that we're only raising tuition this year 3.9%. Now remember, inflation's at like 1.5%, right? Only raising 3.9%, which we're proud to say, is the lowest increase in tuition in 40 years at Notre Dame. 2.5 times the rate of inflation, the lowest increase. And then he says, that's why we're pleased to tell you, the total student cost for next year is $61,750. Now, I'm writing the check. But I shouldn't write the check. I should demand to know what they're spending this on. And I was in New Hampshire, did a town hall meeting, and I brought my daughter Sarah with me. She wanted to see what I was doing as I was going away from home. She was home from school, so I said, come on with me. So she came up, she was sitting there, and I tried to come up with the most ridiculous example I could come up with. I said, what if they told you, they itemized the bill, and they told you that 1% of the tuition cost this year was going to build a rock climbing wall? I thought that was pretty ridiculous, right? My daughter says, we already have one of those, Dad. Now, I told this story at Iowa State today, and there were 20 students sitting behind me, and they said, we already have one of those, too. If we knew we were playing for the rock climbing wall, would we pay the bills quickly? Would they tell us, would they spend the money if we knew they were doing it on the rock climbing wall? Now, I'm all for the full college experience. I've had it. But you know what? There's a lot of folks in this country who can't afford the full college experience but need a college education. So not only should they itemize those bills in my view, but they should unbundle them. and allow people to pay for the things they want. That would put market pressure on tuition costs around our country and make it more affordable for Americans everywhere. And if they don't want to do that, that's fine. But what the federal government should say is that you do not participate in our federal loan or grant programs. You want to accept taxpayer money to have children come to your school, then you need to be transparent with those students and their family about what they're assuming debt for, what you're spending their money on, and what they're getting it. Then we'd have some control of tuition costs in this country, and as a result, a control of debt costs as well. But do you hear the president talk about this stuff? No, because these are real problems that real people talk about around their kitchen tables that make a difference in their lives. As a party, those are the things we need to start talking about. And we need to talk about it in a way where people understand our message in a clear and unmistakable way. Whether it's dealing with Vladimir Putin and the Ayatollah, whether it's dealing with Congress, whether it's dealing with our higher education institutions or the teachers union that runs our education system in this country, we need to start sending clear, direct, unmistakable messages about what we're for and what we're against, what we're willing to pay for and what we won't, and what we will stand up and fight for and what we won't. And there's been too much ambiguity in this world, everybody, for my taste, and I think for yours too. But, you know, sometimes doing this stuff causes you to take in some incoming. You know, the teachers union has spent over $20 million against me in non-election years. Non-election years. And you'll have people who will take shots at you all the time. But that's what leadership is about. Lieutenant Governor said leadership matters, and it does. It does. It's the only thing. It will be the only thing that distinguishes us from the other failed experiments at a democracy. It's will our leaders be strong enough to stand up and do the things that need to be done in all these different areas in order to make our country, once again, the dominant force of the 21st century, the way we were in the 20th century. I absolutely believe that's possible, not only possible, but necessary. Look at what the world looks like when America pulls back. It is an unstable, dangerous, ugly place. And I'll just say one more thing about one more issue before I conclude, and that's this. What happened these past 2 weeks in Congress with our intelligence capability has made America weaker and more vulnerable to terrorist attack from places all around the world and from homegrown terrorists right here in our country. Now, you'll hear these folks who have never done a lick of this work in their life pontificate to you from the floor of the United States Senate and some ridiculous subcommittee room somewhere on Capitol Hill about all their great ideas about intelligence and civil liberties. You're looking at the only guy who could be in this national conversation who's actually done it. I was a U.S. attorney for 7 years. I was nominated by President Bush to be the U.S. attorney in New Jersey on September 10th, 2001. And the next day, one of those planes left from an airport in my state. And more people died in my state than in any state in America other than New York. A dear friend of ours in our parish, in our hometown, was in the Trade Center that day and was killed. My oldest son's best friend's dad was in the Trade Center that day and was killed. We went to those funerals. But more importantly, we've watched their children in our town, in our house, for the last 13 years, live their lives without their father. Every year on his father's birthday, my son's best friend posts a picture of his dad. He was 8 years old when his father died. He posts a picture of his dad on his Facebook page. And all it says underneath it is, "I'll never forget you." Unfortunately, politicians in this country have forgotten. And when you take away tools from our intelligence community, and you say that Congress can't possibly do your oversight job, or the Justice Department can't prosecute people who have broken the law in the intelligence community, you are throwing your hands up in surrender rather than fighting to protect the homeland. I've done it. I've reviewed applications under the Patriot Act. I've reviewed applications to the FISA court. I have prosecuted terrorists and put them in jail in New Jersey. It can be done while protecting people's civil liberties, and it must be done while protecting people's civil liberties in this country. But what we have done, what Congress has done in the last 2 weeks, has taken tools away from those people who are entrusted with the protection of our lives. And then they brag about it. They send it out on the internet, and they send out fundraising solicitations to raise money off those speeches, and then brag about how much money they raised by scaring people about their civil liberties. It's disgraceful, and it's dangerous. And so I'm going to continue to speak out about this, because I speak out from a position of knowledge, something unique in politics. But I actually know what I'm talking about this. And so you need to decide. You need to decide as we pick a new national leader. Do you want someone who wakes up every morning and says, my first job is to make sure I protect the lives of the American people and that I do everything I can within the law to do that? Or are you looking for somebody who's a college professor? We've got one in there now. We don't need another college professor with theories in the Oval Office about things they've never done and never experienced. We need a real person who's going to make real decisions and protect the American people and project American power, authority, and influence around the world so the world's a safer place, not the dangerous place it is today. So that's the directness I was talking to you about. And I'll end where I started. My mom's advice about, be yourself. You don't have to worry about remembering tomorrow what you pretended to be yesterday. And the lessons that she taught me and the reason why they're so important to me. I said I have an Irish father. He's 82 years old. And he's an amazing guy. And I'm so lucky to still have him around. They live streamed part of my speech today from Iowa State on some network. I don't know which one. But I got a text from him as soon as it was done. Watching it, did really well. A couple of comments when you have time to talk. He's an amazing guy. He's a guy who lost his own dad when he was 16 years old. He was on his way to Columbia University. He was the top student in his high school class. And his dad died, and then they didn't have the money for him to go to school. So he didn't. He didn't go to school. He got drafted into the Army during the Korean War. And he came home from the Army and still needed help support his mom and his sisters and his brother. And so he went and took a job at the Breyers Ice Cream Plant in Newark, New Jersey. And he thought it was a pretty good job. He said that he could walk to work from where he lived. They had good wages, he thought, and he got free ice cream. So he thought, this is a really good job. But he had an older guy next to him who was working with him who detected that he was a pretty smart guy. And he kept saying, young man, what are you going to do with your life? He said, I'm going to work right here. This is a great job. I love this job. I can do it. It's good money. I'm going to do this. He said, no. You served your country in the Army. You're entitled to the GI Bill. You need to go to college. There was no father left in his life to be able to encourage him to do this. And this guy brought him around. And my father went and took a couple of classes at Rutgers in Newark at night after he worked all day at the ice cream plant. And he kept going. And he wound up 6 years later, after working all during the day, going to school at night on the GI Bill with what my mother used to call our first family picture. It was my father's graduation day. In June of 1962 at Rutgers, after 6 years of college at night, there he was in his cap and gown with a huge smile, and my mother next to him, 6 months pregnant with me. And she loved that picture. She kept that picture on her dresser her whole life because she said it was the first family picture. And she was so proud of my father, who was the first person in his family to get a college degree. She never got one because she was the product of a single mom, too. And she was the oldest child, and she had to help make money for her family. And I know how proud she was of him then, and that, the only reason I'm here is because my dad took that chance and had that opportunity that our country helped provide for him in return for his service. And he's an incredible role model, an example for me about what hard work can do for you. So I do tell that story sometimes too, just to keep him honest, you know. And I talk about my mom in the past tense because we lost her 11 years ago. And it's an incredible void in my life that she's no longer here. And, you know, she got lung cancer. She was diagnosed on Valentine's Day of 2004 with lung cancer, and it was very aggressive. And for those of you who have family members or friends who have had this disease, you know how bad it can be. And by the end of April of that year, I was off at the U.S. Attorneys Conference in San Diego. My brother called me, and he said to me, listen, Chris, mom's taking a real turn for the worse. She's back in the hospital, and I think if you want to see her, you need to come home now. So I ran to the airport. I got on the red-eye flight from San Diego, and I went back to New Jersey. I landed in Newark the next morning. I got my car, and I drove to the hospital. And mom was there. For those of you who got through this, you know that when they start to give her morphine, that you're really close to the end. They're trying to just control her pain and make her comfortable. So she's kind of in and out of things. And so I was sitting next to the bed waiting for her to come with it. And she did. And it's typical of my mother, right? She hadn't seen me for a week. So I looked at her. I said, hey, mom. She goes, what day is it? I got hello, or how are you, or how was your trip? Or, what day is it? I said, it's Friday. She said, what time is it? I said, it's 9:30 in the morning. And she said, go to work. I said, hey, mom, I decided to take the day off and spend today with you. So don't worry about work today. I've got it covered. I'm going to stay here. She said, Christopher, it is a work day. Go to work. I said, listen, what? You're afraid not getting your taxpayers' money's worth? Like, I'll make it up. I'll make the time up. Don't worry about it. We'll be fine. And she leaned over. She grabbed my hand and said, Christopher, go to work. It's where you belong. There is nothing left unsaid between us. It was an extraordinary moment in my life. She was giving me permission. Give me permission to let her go. And you know, it was only made possible because of the stuff I told you in the beginning. Remember, she said, when I was a kid, there'll be no deathbed confessions here, buddy. You're going to hear it now. She was right. There was no need for it. She had told me everything. Her grievances, and she'd also told me how much she loved me. And because of the way she taught me, I had given her my grievances, and I'd also told her how much I loved her. And so there was nothing left to say. Nothing left to say. So I gave her a kiss on the forehead, and I said, okay, mom, I'm going to work. She said, good. And I left, and she went into a coma that afternoon, and she died 3 days later. I never spoke to her again, but I didn't have to. And I know that if she were here today to see this circus that my life has become, right? Ridiculous, right? She would say two things to me. The first thing she would say is, Christopher, don't get too big for yourself now. Running for office. I changed your diapers, man. I know you. So don't get too big for yourself. And the second thing she would say is, if you decide to run for president and you ask these people for their vote, that is the most trusting relationship outside of family they can have. If they give you their vote to be the leader of their country, well, then you better tell them everything. You better tell them everything you think and everything you feel. You better not hold anything back. And that's the way she raised me. And so for some people, that makes you uncomfortable. And for other people, it makes you stand up and feel good. And there'll be some days where you like what I say, and there'll be other days where you sink your head and you say, I cannot believe he just said that. But here's what you'll never have to say. You'll never have to say, I wonder what he's thinking. I wonder how he feels. I wonder what he believes in. And I wonder what he's willing to fight for. And that should be a comfort to you, for anybody who ascends to leadership in this country. No surprises, no games, none of that. The reason I am this way is because of her. And the best way I can give tribute to her memory is to keep doing that, just that way. That's what she would expect of me, and I believe that's what you should demand of anybody who's going to offer themselves for high office. And so, while I'm one of the most psychoanalyzed national political figures in the world, we've now ended the mystery. You know why I am the way I am. And I don't know why anybody would think that Iowans wouldn't like that. Because everybody in Iowa I've met may not be quite as loud as I am sometimes, but they're very direct. And they tell you what you think. and they're going to hold you to account for what you promise. Well, if I do decide to run for president, everybody, if that's the standard you hold me to, I'm very comfortable. Doesn't mean I'll win, but it means you'll know exactly what you're getting if I do. And so for all of you who care so much about your communities and your state and our country, to show up tonight and to support this party and support folks like me and Kim and the governor, well, we can't thank you enough for that. And I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to be here tonight and to be part of this. And so thank you for the chance to speak to all of you. Thank you for your attention and your friendship and your courtesy. And you can be guaranteed you'll see me down the road real soon. We'll see you.